Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for November 12th, 2021. I'm your reader, Stephen Gazier. Ag and environment. High cost. Short supply of fertilizer to alter 2022 planting. By Jared Strong, November 8th, 2021. Farmers in the United States are likely to plant less corn and use less nitrogen fertilizer on their fields for next year's growing season due to sky-high fertilizer prices and short supplies. That trend will be less pronounced in Iowa, where fertile soils make the extra cost worthwhile. Quote, "We have a very natural advantage for producing corn," said Sam Funk, a senior economist for Iowa Farm Bureau. "Those nitrogen fertilizers are worth more on very productive Iowa ground rather than in other states." A confluence of factors has led to agricultural fertilizers to reach their highest prices in two decades, according to Green Markets, which tracks those price trends. Global natural gas shortages, limited fertilizer stockpiles, and other factors had already driven those prices upward this year when Hurricane Ida made landfall in Louisiana in August. The storm halted fertilizer production in the storm-affected areas and stalled transportation barges on the Mississippi River. Quote, "You've got a lot of different factors that are coming to bear at certain moment in time," Funk said. He said farmers are paying up to three times the price for fertilizer they paid a year ago, and some say it's worse. Quote, "Some of our farmers who have been able to guarantee fertilizer availability for next planting season have reported being quoted prices up to six times as high as 2021 prices," U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra, a Northwest Iowa Republican, said during a congressional hearing last week. Some farmers may wait to fertilize. So what will farmers do? Some are waiting to fertilize their fields until the spring, and some are eyeing alternatives to corn, Chat Hart, an economics professor at Iowa State University, said Friday on Iowa Press, which airs on Iowa PBS. One alternative is soybeans, which make their own nitrogen through a symbiotic relationship with certain bacteria. Brady Rhizobium Japonicum can infect soybean roots in exchange for the plant's sugars, the bacteria can fix nitrogen. Quote, "Will Iowa producers switch more over to soybeans?" Funk said. "Some, but not probably to a great extent in the state. You have a yield factor that would penalize you for planting soybeans after soybeans." Corn and soybean yields benefit when they are planted in alternating years in fields. Back-to-back years of soybean planting reduces yields, primarily because of the increased presence of microscopic roundworms that damage the roots, researchers have found. Funk said many Iowa farmers will simply be more judicious with their fertilizer applications and take an economic hit from the higher costs. Justice. Court upholds conviction of man who went through five lawyers before trial. By Clark Kaufman, November 8, 2021. The Iowa Court of Appeals has upheld the willful injury conviction of a Polk County man who was sentenced to 35 years in prison after rejecting five attorneys and choosing to represent himself at trial. In March 2017, James DeRio Robinson was arrested and charged with burglary in the first degree, willful injury causing serious injury, first degree harassment, and false imprisonment. Over the next 2 years, he was represented at pretrial proceedings by attorneys Thomas Graves, Gerald Feuerhelm, Jesse Macro Jr., Gary Dickey, and Christine Branstad. In each instance, there was breakdown in communication between Robinson and his lawyer. At one court hearing, Robinson accused his lawyers of working with prosecutors in the case as part of, quote, "the good old white buddy network," end quote. In the year leading up to his trial, licensed psychologist Dr. Michael Huston evaluated Robinson and on April 16, 2018, found Robinson, quote, "was fully oriented," end quote, and had, quote, "sufficient mental abilities to be considered competent to stand trial at this time," end quote. The next day, however, Huston filed a letter with the court and changed his opinion based on information gleaned from one of Robinson's attorneys, telling the judge that Robinson, quote, "can be considered not competent to stand trial," end quote. In October 2018, Huston offered a new opinion, telling the court Robinson was competent to stand trial, an opinion that another doctor also shared. In April 2019, Robinson stood trial, acting as his own attorney with assistance from standby counsel. While testifying, he admitted striking, stabbing, choking, and stomping on his girlfriend during a fight in March 2017. He relied on a defense of diminished capacity and testified about an alleged brain injury he had suffered during shoulder surgery. He did not offer into evidence any documentation to support his claim of a brain injury. The jury convicted Robinson on all counts, as charged, and he was sentenced to prison for a term of no more than 35 years. Robinson appealed the conviction, arguing he wasn't competent either to stand trial or represent himself, and that the court abused its discretion in failing to strike a juror who had voiced concerns about his own ability to be impartial. Prior to the trial, a county prosecutor had asked the juror, quote, "Do you have any concerns about your ability to be fair and impartial in this case?" The juror replied, "Absolutely." To which the prosecutor responded, quote, "You do have concerns about that?" End quote. "Yeah," the juror replied. On further questioning, the juror said he would try to keep an open mind and said he'd like to consider himself, quote, "pretty reasonable," end quote. The Court of Appeals rejected Robinson's appeal, noting that he was examined and judged to be competent before trial. With regard to the juror, the court pointed out that Robinson did not take action himself to strike the man from the pool of potential jurors. Justice. Convicted killer to be refunded $50,000 intended for victim restitution. By Clark Kaufman, November 8, 2021. A convicted murderer is entitled to the $50,000 in cash that a judge had designated for victim restitution, the Iowa Court of Appeals has ruled. According to court records, James Farnsworth II was arrested by Mason City Police in April 2012 for the stabbing death of Ian Decker. In the hours before the stabbing, Farnsworth's girlfriend, Victoria Miller, had received a text of a smiley face from Decker, her former boyfriend and the father of her child. Later that same evening, the three met at an apartment building and the two men fought, with Decker throwing the first punch, court records state. After the two grappled on the ground, Decker stood up, revealing blood streaming down his chest. He then collapsed, and Farnsworth drove away. Decker died at the scene from a stab wound that had pierced his heart. Farnsworth was charged with first-degree murder, and in January 2013, he was convicted of second-degree murder. He later filed an application for post-conviction relief, raising several claims that alleged ineffective assistance of legal counsel. Following an evidentiary hearing, the district court denied the application, which led to an appeal. One of the claims made by Farnsworth related to the $50,000 cash bond he had posted prior to his trial, guaranteeing his appearance in court. The bond contained language authorizing the clerk of court to use the bail bond to, quote, "pay all fines, surcharges, costs, and victim restitution," end quote, that might later be ordered by the court. After the jury returned its verdict, the sentencing order issued by the judge required Farnsworth to pay $150,000 in damages to Decker's heirs, plus $14,972 to the Crime Victim Assistance Program. At the time, the judge expressed an intent to apply the $50,000 cash bond toward the victim restitution debt, unless the state or Farnsworth's attorney filed an objection. Neither did so, and so the court forfeited the bond, and the $50,000 was applied to the restitution debt. On appeal, Farnsworth argued that his attorney mishandled his appearance bond, first by raising the issue in court, which led to the original bond of $100,000 being doubled, with the added proviso that $50,000 had to be submitted by Farnsworth in cash and in his own name. Quote, "This was clearly intended to create a fund out of which statutory restitution could be paid in the event of the conviction," Farnsworth argued on appeal. He said his own attorney had advised him such a maneuver was illegal and that potential victim restitution can't be considered by the court when setting a defendant's bond amount. The Court of Appeals found that Farnsworth's attorney erred in failing to object to the court's application of the $50,000 to victim restitution, since the courts have previously stated that the disposition of any pretrial bail money that was paid out should not be part of the subsequent sentencing process. Quote, "Counsel had a duty to object to the district court's expressed intent to apply the cash bond amount to his outstanding restitution obligation," the Court of Appeals ruled. The court ruled against Farnsworth on his other claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. The court ordered that the case be returned to district court so that the clerk of court can return the money to Farnsworth as required by Iowa law. COVID-19, working and economy, capital clicks. Iowa receives $5.3 million for tourism ads, improving rest stops. By Katie Aiken, November 8, 2021. Iowa will use a $5.27 million grant from the U.S. Department of Commerce to promote tourism to the state and improve technology at four state-owned rest stops. U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo announced Monday that the department has awarded $314 million in a first round of state grants. The money is meant to assist the tourism industry as it recovers from severely decreased travel during the COVID-19 pandemic. Quote, The state tourism grants give states and territories the flexible opportunity to boost their local tourism industry and ensure that jobs are restored and tourists return safely, Raimondo said in a news release. A spokesperson for the Iowa Economic Development Authority said Iowa's $5.3 million grant will go toward tourism marketing and improving technology at Iowa's four welcome centers in Davis City, Underwood, Wilton, and Sergeant Bluff. Quote, as you know, tourism was hit especially hard during 2020, wrote IEDA spokesperson Jessica O'Reilly in an email. These funds will help increase visitation to Iowa destinations to pre-2020 levels. O'Reilly said IEDA plans to keep promoting outdoor destinations that remain popular through the pandemic. She pointed toward the Iowa State Park Passport Program, which encourages Iowans and visitors to explore the park system. The first round of grant funding comes as the U.S. lifts international travel restrictions for people vaccinated against COVID-19. A news release from the Federal Economic Development Administration called the removal of travel restrictions and the grant program, quote, critical steps in the recovery of the travel and tourism sector from the coronavirus pandemic. Education. Capital clicks. Iowa Board of Regents launches free speech survey for students, staff. By Katie Aiken, November 9, 2021. The Iowa Board of Regents launched its first free speech survey on Tuesday, part of a multi-step plan to protect freedom of expression at the state's public universities. The survey asked university staff and students to respond to a set of statements about free speech, ranking them from strongly agree to strongly disagree. The survey ends on December 1st. Chief Academic Officer Rachel Boone said the Regents worked with university administrators to create the survey statements. The Board of Regents plans to conduct the free speech survey every 2 years. It differs from the existing campus climate survey, Boone said, because it will focus exclusively on free speech issues, and the survey data will be consistent across the three universities. Boone did not know yet what the Regents will do with the survey data once it is completed. Iowa lawmakers seized on university free speech issues during the 2021 legislative session, holding several meetings lambasting school administrators for incidents in which a conservative student or group felt their free speech rights were limited on campus. In response, the Board of Regents convened a committee on free speech, which developed a set of 10 recommendations for universities. Some of the recommendations have already taken effect, like a mandatory syllabus statement that recognizes academic freedom and a website for students to report free speech concerns. Republican leaders said that free speech issues on campus may have played into the decision not to increase funding for the region's universities. They also pointed to lingering COVID-19 aid and declining enrollment as reasons not to increase the budget. Quote, Regents have had issues on various subjects, but you know, I believe the Regents are taking some steps in the right direction. Representative David Kerr, Republican, Morning Sun, said in an April subcommittee on the budget. And then next year, we can see how the progress is going there, too. Government and politics. Capital clicks. Party leaders meet with Brown and Black Forums of America on racism. Caucuses. By Katie Aiken, November 9, 2021. Iowa's Democratic and Republican Party leaders met last week with the Brown and Black Forums of America to discuss Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucuses and a series of racist threats against Iowa Democratic Party Chair Ross Wilburn. Wayne Ford and Mary Campos, co-chairs of the Iowa-based Brown and Black Forums of America, said in a statement that they, quote, condemn in the strongest way possible the recent threats against Chair Wilburn. In October, an anonymous person called and emailed racist threats to Wilburn following a critical column about former President Donald Trump. Wilburn said Tuesday that the investigation into the incident is ongoing, and he hopes to get a formal update soon. Quote, this is just the latest in a long pattern of racist actions against political activists of color in Iowa, Ford and Campos said. In the spirit of unity, we stand with political leaders across party lines who discourage these deplorable activities. Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman has also condemned the threats. Both Wilburn and Kaufman also advocated for the Iowa caucuses to remain first in the nominating calendar. The caucus faced significant criticism last year after Democrats had issues with a new reporting system. Plus, critics of the process have argued for decades that Iowa is not diverse enough to serve as an indicator for the rest of the country. The party chair spoke with the co-chairs of the Brown and Black Forums about Iowa's place on the calendar in last week's meeting. Quote, work on the 2024 presidential caucuses has already begun, and just as I have done with six other Democrat party chairs, I am pleased to stand arm-in-arm with Chair Wilburn to preserve the Iowa caucuses, Kaufman said. Campos and Ford did not say in their Tuesday statement whether they supported keeping the Iowa caucus first, and a representative for the forums did not respond to a request for clarification. But the duo has been addressing the critics for years. In a 2004 Democracy Now! Interview, Ford said the minorities in Iowa, quote, have the same symbolic issues as other minorities around the country, end quote. Quote, although we are the fifth whitest state in America, me and Mary have always said we need to showcase minorities and let the country know that we have a similar problem, and these presidential candidates need to deal with these problems, Ford said in 2004. Healthcare. Chiropractor convicted of assaulting woman pays $105 fine, keeps license. By Clark Kaufman, November 9, 2021. A West Burlington chiropractor convicted of assaulting a female patient will pay a $105 fine and be allowed to continue practicing chiropractic in Iowa. In April 2020, the Iowa Board of Chiropractic alleged that on multiple occasions, Joel Thomas Rexroth of the Rexroth Chiropractic Center had grabbed the breasts of a female patient, made lewd comments about her breasts, made inappropriate requests of the patient, and ultimately was criminally charged with four counts of assault. At the time, the board issued an emergency suspension of Rexroth's license. 2 months later, in June 2020, the board filed a new order in the case in which it said it was rescinding the suspension. The new order allowed Rexroth to practice and see female patients with a chaperone present. In exchange, Rexroth agreed to undergo a psychosexual evaluation and to, quote, promptly dismiss, end quote, a lawsuit he had filed against the board a few weeks before. In that lawsuit, Rexroth said the allegations against him were false and that the board had failed to perform any investigation before suspending his license. He also blamed the alleged victim, stating in his court petition, quote, the complainant herself initiated the single minor incident, ellipses. Complainant is married and is blaming Rexroth to avoid responsibility for her own initiation of the minor incident. As agreed, Rexroth dismissed the lawsuit within days of the board rescinding his license suspension. Recently, the board issued a final settlement in the licensing case, ordering Rexroth to pay a $1,000 civil penalty and complete a program on professional ethics. As part of that settlement, Rexroth has agreed to only provide chiropractic care in an office setting and to have a chaperone present for the treatment of all female patients over the next 12 months. Police records indicate Rexroth was a close friend of the alleged victim's husband. The woman had told authorities she was first assaulted in October 2019 at the Rexroth Chiropractic Center. She claimed Rexroth placed his hand under her shirt and pulled her breasts out of her bra, asking her, quote, do you know how long it has been since I've seen Big Dash S? She told police she protested, at which point Rexroth let go of her and she left the clinic. He allegedly made similar advances during three subsequent meetings at either the clinic or the home of the patient's family. Court records indicate police were later given a tape recording of a conversation between Rexroth and the patient's husband. On the tape, the husband allegedly can be heard asking Rexroth, quote, did you put your hand under her shirt and touch her boob? End quote. According to police, the tape captures Rexroth replying, quote, I pulled her shirt up and touched it, and I am sorry, end quote, adding that he was drunk at the time. When asked by the husband if he had made similar advances on other occasions, Rexroth is allegedly heard on the tape replying, quote, there was three, I think, end quote. The criminal case was resolved late last week with a plea agreement that resulted in the dismissal of three of the four counts of assault. On the fourth count, Rexroth was fined $105 and granted a deferred judgment, which will result in the case being expunged from the public record after the successful completion of a six-month probationary period. Justice. Lawsuit alleges negligence leading to Madison County inmates' suicide. By Clark Kaufman, November 10, 2021. Madison County and a community health organization are facing a wrongful death lawsuit over the 2020 suicide of a jail inmate. The federal lawsuit, which appears to draw heavily from audio and video recordings made at the Madison County Jail, gives a detailed, minute-by-minute account of the alleged events leading up to the suicide of 39-year-old Jordan Payne. Payne's family is alleging negligence on the part of the county and Airlie Ball Community Health Services. Before his arrest in June 2020, on a simple misdemeanor charge of contempt of court, Payne allegedly had a history of mental illness and depression. In February 2015, Payne was involuntarily committed following an allegation of serious mental impairment. On April 20th of that year, while in the custody of the Madison County Sheriff's Office, he had allegedly attempted suicide by hanging himself with a phone cord around his neck. Then, in August 2016, he was transported to the Madison County Hospital by the sheriff's office after a suicide attempt in which he cut his wrist with a knife. Immediately after his June 2020 arrest, Payne was booked into the jail and allegedly answered a series of intake screening questions to indicate he was suffering from mental illness, had been hospitalized in the past 12 months, had tried in the past to hurt himself, and had tried in the past to kill himself. Despite that, and despite Payne's history, the sheriff's staff allegedly placed Payne in a single cell without taking any suicide prevention measures. On June 11th, 2 days after being booked into the jail, Payne allegedly began sending a series of text messages to his girlfriend, which the jail staff was capable of monitoring. Payne allegedly wrote, quote, "Something's not right in my head and my chest. I'm hearing voices that won't stop. WTF is wrong with me. Ellipses. I need to talk to Eve. This is an emergency. Ellipses. Just not right in the head. Ellipses. I'm going back to crying and smashing head off wall. Ellipses. Smashing my head off the wall stops voices. Ellipses. My head is telling to rip out my veins with my teeth." End quote. A jail employee, Linda Barker, told her colleagues at the jail that Payne was texting his girlfriend and saying he was, quote, "ready to chew out his veins," end quote. On June 12th, Payne asked the jail staff if he could see a doctor, saying, quote, "my head's not right," end quote. An hour later, he was allowed to meet with Scott Thomas, an Ira Lee Ball employee who has an undergraduate degree in sociology. During that meeting, which was recorded, Payne allegedly said, quote, "I'm not doing so well. I lost everything. Girlfriend, Jeep, house. Going to be homeless," ellipses. "I've got these thoughts in my head that are like chew my veins out, and I mean S word. Like that," ellipses. "I've had 7 suicide attempts in the last year," end quote. After the meeting, Payne was immediately escorted back to his cell. 7 minutes later, allegedly in clear view of the jail's monitored video surveillance system, Payne tried to fashion a noose out of a blanket and then secure it to the cell door, trying twice to lift himself high enough to get the noose around his neck. He then removed the blanket from the interior door and entered the shower portion of his cell, where he succeeded in hanging himself at 2:05 p.m., 9 minutes after his meeting with Thomas had ended. The lawsuit alleges the jail surveillance video includes, quote, "audible banging followed by gasping noises that are clearly heard," end quote, on the tape. At 2:14 p.m., a jailer conducted a check of the neighboring cell, but did not check Payne's cell. About 12 minutes later, that same jailer returned and again checked the neighboring cell without checking on Payne. 1 hour and 11 minutes after Payne had hung himself, the jailer allegedly entered Payne's cell, called his name, and received no answer. The jailer left the cell without checking the shower area, but almost immediately returned, opened the shower area door, and found Payne hanging. The lawsuit claims the conduct of the sheriff's office, quote, "was outrageous and was undertaken with reckless disregard of the probability of Jordan Payne's death," end quote. In addition to Madison County and Ira Lee Ball, the defendants in the case are Thomas, Sheriff Jason Barnes, and jailer John Weakland. They have yet to file a response to the lawsuit. Criminal justice and policing justice. Davenport banker accused of fraud and million-dollar scheme targeting the SBA. By Clark Kaufman, November 10, 2021. An Iowa banking executive accused of attempting to defraud the Small Business Administration through a scheme involving millions of dollars has pleaded guilty to a charge of wire fraud. Larry Charles Henson of Davenport, the former president and chairman of the now-shuttered Valley Bank in Moline, Illinois, is expected to be sentenced March 8th. He is accused of conspiring with others to shift millions of dollars in potential losses from Valley Bank to the SBA. Court records indicate Valley Bank worked with a lending institution based in Clive, identified by prosecutors only as Company 1, to assist Valley in making SBA-backed loans that the federal agency would pay off should the borrowers default. According to prosecutors, the founder and president of Company 1, identified by prosecutors only as Co-Conspirator 1, worked with Henson and other Valley Bank employees to engineer those loans so that it appeared the borrowers qualified for SBA guarantees. To do this, they allegedly completed loan guarantee applications that included false statements about both the borrower's eligibility to receive the loans and the eventual disbursement of the loan proceeds. For example, in September 2011, Valley Bank allegedly attempted to shed itself of any risk associated with the $5 million loan it had made to a Kentucky-based business that was highly leveraged and had limited capital. Co-conspirator 1 allegedly advised Henson to, quote, "do everything possible to make sure the borrower is not more than 29 days late," end quote, in payments to ensure that their application for an SBA-backed refinancing of the loan would be approved, even if that meant having Valley Bank grant the borrower a 90-day deferral of payments. Co-conspirator 1 is also alleged to have called Henson and suggested a variety of ways in which a bank could fraudulently conceal from the SBA the fact that a loan was at risk of default. Shortly after that, co-conspirator 1 called the Valley Bank vice president, Andrew Erpelding, to alert him that the loan couldn't be refinanced by the SBA because of previous past due payments. Erpelding allegedly called Henson and told him of the problem, after which the two men jointly called Valley Bank vice president Susan McLaughlin, instructing her to alter the bank's loan payment reports. McLaughlin allegedly complied, changing the borrower's payment history to eliminate any delinquent payments. The bank, along with co-conspirator 1, then transmitted the falsified information to the SBA as part of the application for refinancing. At around the same time, the SBA denied Valley Bank's application to refinance a $4.6 million loan involving a Florida company, pointing out that the borrower was already a guarantor on two other SBA loans that were in default. Co-conspirator 1 is alleged to have then submitted a new application for the loan, this time identifying the borrower only through an acronym of the borrower's actual name. With no credit history attached to that fictitious name, the SBA contacted Valley Bank and asked for its payment records and other documents tied to the loan. Co-conspirator 1 allegedly emailed Erpelding and explained to him that the bank would need to rewrite its loan documents to put them all in the fictitious name used on the SBA application and then make sure there were no delinquent payments referenced in those documents. The SBA approved the falsified application, and the borrower ultimately defaulted, leaving the federal agency on the hook for $2.1 million. A few months later, in January 2012, Valley Bank attempted to shift to the SBA its risk of losses tied to a loan the bank had made to another Florida company, court documents state. As before, it attempted to do so by refinancing the loan through the SBA. As part of that refinancing, the borrower was requesting $5 million, with $3.7 million to be used in paying off loans, and $1.3 million designated as working capital. One problem with the refinancing request, the borrower had a net worth of only $408,000. To help ensure SBA approval, co-conspirator 1 is alleged to have falsely inflated the borrower's net worth to $2.2 million, with $750,000 in savings and other assets worth more than $1 million. Prosecutors say Erpelding then falsely informed the SBA that the borrower would be injecting $750,000 of his own money into the business. The SBS ultimately approved the $5 million loan. The borrower defaulted and the SBA sustained $34 million in losses. Henson was recently indicted on a single count of wire fraud. He pleaded guilty to the charge Tuesday and acknowledged that he now faces a maximum sentence of 30 years in prison and a fine of $1 million. As for co-conspirator 1 and the role played by others in the alleged scheme, the U.S. Department of Justice said Wednesday the case remains under investigation. In 2016, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and Henson entered into a settlement under which the former executive consented to an order of prohibition from any further participation in the affairs of any financial institution. COVID-19, healthcare, Dubuque, Johnson, and rural counties fuel new COVID uptick. By Jared Strong, November 10, 2021. New confirmed coronavirus cases are rising again in Iowa despite dwindling or stagnant infection rates in some of the state's largest counties. One reason is Dubuque County, where the two-week infection rate doubled in the past month, according to state data. Quote, I know we are not plateauing yet this week, and I don't know what's going to happen in the next 7 days, said Mary Rose Corrigan, public health specialist for the city of Dubuque. We'd like to think it's going to go down, but as I look in the community and see the majority of people not wearing masks and continuing to be with others in groups indoors, I don't know. In terms of total new cases over the past 7 days, Dubuque's 536 cases were only eclipsed by Polk County, which had 909. Polk's population is 5 times the size of Dubuque's. Johnson County, where Iowa City is located, also has a considerable surge that began in late October and had nearly 400 new cases in the past 7 days, state data show. Children represent 43% of those new cases. Statewide, children accounted for 23% of new cases during the same period, a percentage that has remained mostly steady since the start of the school year. The state's two-week rate of infection peaked in September and steadily declined until late October, when it began to slowly rise again. Among the less populated counties, Taylor in southern Iowa had a recent one-week period that matched its new infections during the height of the pandemic in November. Sandy Boswell, nurse supervisor for the county's public health department, said the 61 new cases were a result of broad community spread. Quote, "It's just the events that we normally have," she said. "There was Halloween, there were ball games," ellipses. "People don't mask. They go to all the events, but they don't protect themselves. Once a family gets it, the whole family gets it because the variant is so much more virulent." Other small counties with surging infection rates include Decatur, where 42% of new cases were children in the past week, Clark, Wright, and Winnebago. Hospitalizations are rising again as well. As of Wednesday, 524 residents were admitted for treatment for COVID-19, according to state data, which was up from 515 the day before. About 71% of those patients were unvaccinated for the virus before being infected. Among people younger than 60, the unvaccinated account for 85% of hospitalizations. For those who are 80 and older and admitted for treatment, about half are vaccinated. You are listening to the reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for November 12, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's continue with this week's stories. COVID-19, Government and Politics. Iowa joins third lawsuit against federal vaccine mandates. By Katie Aiken, November 10, 2021. Governor Kim Reynolds announced Wednesday that Iowa has joined a third lawsuit against federal vaccine mandates. The newest lawsuit targets a federal mandate that requires employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19 if they work at healthcare facilities that receive Medicare or Medicaid funds. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services requirement gives staff 1 month to get the first shot, and then until January 4th to be fully vaccinated. Reynolds argued in a news release that the requirement is an, quote, attack on individual liberties, end quote, and that it could worsen workforce shortages in the healthcare industry. Quote, medical providers that have been on the front lines of this pandemic, saving lives, deserve the freedom and ability to make their own informed healthcare decisions, Reynolds said in a release. Iowa has 5 state-operated facilities that accept Medicare and Medicaid, including the Iowa Veterans Home and the Glenwood and Woodward Resource Centers. The Iowa Veterans Home in October experienced its 6th outbreak of the pandemic, the most of any long-term care facility in the state, and the Glenwood Resource Center has had one of the highest refusal rates of state-run facilities. Iowa joins 9 other states in the lawsuit. This is the third such lawsuit in recent weeks, as Iowa also challenged a vaccine mandate for federal employees and a mandate for employees of large companies. On Monday, a U.S. federal appeals court froze the mandate for large companies, which had been scheduled to take effect in early January. The Biden administration urged companies to move ahead with the new rules anyway. Government and politics. Miller Meeks to seek re-election in Iowa's new 1st District. U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks announced Wednesday that she'll be running in Iowa's newly drawn 1st District in 2022. Quote, "I'm running for re-election in Iowa's 1st District," Miller Meeks tweeted on Wednesday morning. "I'm committed to standing up to Washington Democrats and their socialist agenda by doing everything in my power to fight for Iowan common sense values." Iowa's redistricting process drew Miller Meeks' home county of Wapello into the 3rd District, where Democrat Representative Cindy Axne resides. The new 1st District, which covers many of the southeastern Iowa counties that Miller Meeks currently represents, did not have an incumbent living within its borders. Republican colleagues supported Miller Meeks' decision in statements Wednesday. Representative Ashley Hinson, who now lives and will run for re-election in the 2nd District, tweeted, quote, "Let's go win back the House in 2022, end quote. Senator Chuck Grassley said he was proud to support, quote, "a veteran, a doctor, and a public servant fighting for Iowans in our nation's capital," end quote. The Iowa Democratic Party criticized Miller Meeks for, quote, "abandoning her hometown to run for office," end quote. Quote, "No matter what district she decides to move to, Iowa Democrats are fired up and already working to kick her out in 2022, the party wrote in a news release. Representative Christina Bohannon, a University of Iowa law professor, announced her challenge to Miller Meeks in August. She also switched her candidacy from the former 2nd District to the newly drawn 1st District. One more Democrat has quietly entered the race, Joseph Kerner, who filed with the Federal Election Commission in late September. He had raised just $3,000 before an October filing deadline, far less than Bohannon's $305,000 haul. Government and politics, working and economy. National Republican group takes aim at Deer Strike supporters. By Katie Aiken, November 10th, 2021. As the John Deere strike enters its fifth week, a national Republican organization took aim at Iowa Democrats for supporting union workers. The National Republican Senatorial Committee, an organization devoted to winning back a GOP Senate majority, issued a news release Wednesday criticizing Senate candidate Abby Finkenauer for supporting striking workers. Quote, "Far from actually representing the voices of hardworking Iowa farmers, Finkenauer is instead siding with union strikers whose actions are jeopardizing entire crops and the livelihood of farmers all across Iowa," the news release said. The NRSC then cited entire paragraphs from an Iowa Field Report article alleging that the strike had gone on too long and that it was, quote, "inflicting trauma on one of America's most important demographics, the family farmer." Finkenauer responded with a statement Wednesday, condemning the NRSC statement and criticizing Senator Chuck Grassley's record on unions. Quote, "Let me be clear. If they want to attack me for standing with hardworking Iowans who give their all for their families, like the very one I grew up in, all I can say is, more please," Finkenauer wrote. Iowa Democrats also voiced their support for the striking workers and for Finkenauer in a Wednesday call with reporters. Quote, "The people jeopardizing the crops and the future of farming in Iowa are the John Deere management people who are not coming up with a contract that's fair for the workers who are striking," said Iowa House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst. She added that the NRSC, quote, "isn't on the ground here," end quote, whereas Finkenauer is speaking to Iowans. Quote, "We'd rather hear from her than some folks in Washington," Confirst said. Despite the NRSC news release, Iowa Republican leaders have mostly remained quiet on the union's efforts. Governor Kim Reynolds told reporters Wednesday she does not intend to intervene in the strike. Quote, "We're letting the process work out, and it is working out," Reynolds said, according to Radio Iowa. "They'll continue to come to the table, they'll continue to work on the negotiations, and hopefully they'll reach that settlement sooner rather than later." In the early days of the strike, Finkenauer's opponent Grassley recognized the right of workers to strike. Quote, "And that's a decision those workers made, and under the laws we have to respect it," Grassley said in mid-October. The following day, Grassley tweeted that he went on strike while working in a factory, and he hoped for a swift conclusion to the Deere conflict. A tweet by Chuck Grassley, at Chuck Grassley. "For many years, I was a factory worker and union member, and I did go on strike as part of that experience. The Deere workers and their families now face a stressful situation. I hope good faith bargaining can bring the dispute to swift conclusion for the good of all parties and our Iowa economy." 12:57 p.m., October 15th, 2021. COVID-19 healthcare. Iowa counties launch COVID clinics for kids this week. By Jared Strong, November 9th, 2021. COVID-19 vaccinations for children ages 5 to 11 are becoming widely available this week, with county health departments receiving their first shipments of vaccine doses. "Many counties received their first allotment of doses on Monday, and all counties should have them by week's end," said Sarah Ekstrand, a spokesperson for the Iowa Department of Public Health. Quote, "If vaccines are not immediately available in a community, please remain patient as providers wait for their supply," Ekstrand said. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has assured states that the pediatric vaccine supply is adequate, and states are able to order more doses to meet demand. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the dissemination of Pfizer's vaccine for children late last month. Iowa ordered about 99,000 doses, most of which has now been received, Ekstrand said. The state's coronavirus website is expected to soon begin publishing vaccination rates for Iowa children ages 5 to 11. Some counties, such as Lyon in the far northwest Iowa, launched pediatric clinics on Tuesday. Quote, "It's always exciting when medicine is able to advance and add protection and safety for people," said Melissa Stilson, public health administrator for Lyon County Health Services, which received 300 doses on Monday. "A lot of people are interested. They're taking trips, and they want to get at least that first dose in before Thanksgiving. Ellipses. Some want to wait and see. They want to know how their kids' friends handle it, which is pretty normal." Counties are varied in their clinic scheduling. Carroll County received doses on Monday and then scheduled a clinic for Tuesday morning, whereas Delaware County had its first clinic scheduled for the middle of next week. Nearly 56% of Iowans are fully vaccinated, according to the CDC. Johnson County leads all their counties in the state with a 65% vaccination rate, and Davis County is last with 33.5%. Cass County is set to hold its first clinic on Wednesday and had planned to inoculate up to 150 children. As of Tuesday morning, about half of the available appointments were scheduled. Quote, "We were very excited when we got them," Beth Olson, director of Cass County Public Health, said of receiving the first doses. "I told the FedEx lady, I'm so happy to see you." Olson said her department is the only source of the pediatric vaccine in the county, and that she'll use clinics or other group vaccinations to avoid potential waste from opening vials and not using all the doses they contain. Hy-Vee pharmacies were among the first to offer the child vaccines after receiving them late last week from the CDC. Appointments are available through the grocer's website. Quote, the demand has been high, said Christina Gaiman, a Hy-Vee spokesperson. Medicap Pharmacy also began vaccinations this past weekend at certain locations in central Iowa. On Monday, it provided vaccines for 110 children of a group of eager Waukee parents. Quote, it's gone pretty smoothly so far, said Laura Weber, a marketing spokesperson for Medicap Central Iowa. There is a little hesitancy, similar to when vaccinations were first starting. She said the Medicap location in Carlisle has a clinic set for Saturday, and 50 children have appointments. Justice. State seeks injunction to stop furnace repairmen implicated in customer's death. By Clark Kaufman, November 11, 2021. The state of Iowa is going to court to stop an unlicensed heating contractor from continuing to ply his trade in central Iowa, alleging his work has caused the death of a customer. The Iowa Plumbing and Mechanical Systems Board is seeking a court injunction restraining Jack Archer of Pleasant Hill from either contracting for or performing services in the plumbing, refrigeration, or heating and air conditioning trades without first obtaining a license. The board is also seeking an order requiring Archer to pay civil penalties leveled against him in the past. According to the lawsuit, for many years, Archer has held himself out as a professional installer of HVAC units, the term used to describe heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. At times, Archer has contracted freely with customers, but also has performed work as an employee or contractor working for separate businesses. The board alleges Archer cannot legally do such work due to the lack of a license. The board claims that although Archer has been aware of Iowa's licensure requirements for at least the past 5 years, he has refused to become licensed despite multiple warnings that he is required to do so. Archer, the board says, quote, has ignored and never paid previous administrative penalties while continuing to work brazenly without a license, end quote. During that time, the board has allegedly received multiple complaints alleging, quote, poor workmanship causing injury, damage, or both, end quote. Quote, worst of all, the board alleges, in 2019, an Ankeny townhome resident passed away after defendant Archer performed work on the furnace in the townhome. The decedent's autopsy report indicated the cause of death was acute carbon monoxide toxicity. In seeking an injunction, the board says it has exercised all of its available administrative options, including the imposition of substantial civil penalties, but Archer, quote, refuses to listen. Complaints date back to 2016. According to the board, it first fielded a complaint about Archer's lack of license in June 2016. After 3 years, the case was resolved with an order imposing a $1,000 civil penalty, which remains unpaid. In July 2019, the board received a complaint alleging that in June of that year, Archer was hired to install a central air conditioning unit and furnace at an address on Waitress Avenue in Des Moines. The complaint alleged Archer's work was substandard and left the property in a dangerous condition. Archer allegedly admitted he did not complete the job, telling board investigators it was because the property owner refused to pay for all the work needed to properly complete the job. He allegedly admitted to investigators that he did not obtain the required city permits prior to beginning the work. Archer named in a wrongful death case. In early 2020, Archer performed furnace work at a property located on Guthrie Avenue in Des Moines. When a city inspector examined the work, he found that the joints on the furnace exhaust pipe were so loose they fell apart in his hands due to not being sealed and glued in place. In his petition to the court, the board notes that furnace exhaust, if not properly routed outdoors and vented, can infiltrate the occupied space of a building and cause injury or death to anyone inside. The city inspector subsequently filed a complaint with the board about Archer's work on the Waitress Avenue job. During its investigation, the board learned from a contractor that Archer had been doing HVAC work without a license for about 40 years. By that time, the board alleges, another complaint has been made about work done by Archer that, quote, tragically resulted in Iowan's death from acute carbon monoxide toxicity. The board alleges that on January 31, 2019, a landlord dispatched Archer to a townhome in Ankeny in response to a tenant's complaint that the heat was not working. Archer worked on the furnace, and a few days later, on February 3rd, the 42-year-old tenant, Kevin Straw, was found dead inside the home, kneeling by his bed. An autopsy report indicated he died from acute carbon monoxide toxicity. Straw's death resulted in a wrongful death lawsuit naming Archer as a defendant, and also generated another complaint to the board. As part of its investigation, the board obtained a transcript of a deposition Archer gave under oath in the wrongful death case. According to the board, Archer testified that he believed the licensing program the board administers is not for the protection of the public and is simply a revenue-generating mechanism for the state. The wrongful death case was settled out of court prior to trial, but in response to a complaint about work done at Straw's home, and in response to the two prior unresolved complaints, the board fined Archer a total of $34,000 in March of this year. In seeking an injunction, the board has told the court that, quote, Archer's actions and words both indicate he will not listen to the board no matter how many dollars in fines it assesses, and no matter how sternly the board words its communications and orders. Ellipses. Public health, safety, and welfare are at stake. Archer has yet to file a response to the board's court filing. The Iowa Capital Dispatch was unable to reach him for comment Thursday. A hearing in the case is scheduled for November 16th. Commentary. Hoaxes and scams take an emotional toll. By Michael Bujega, November 6, 2021. Countless people have lost millions of dollars to online hoaxes and scams, but the biggest collective loss concerns trust. Losing trust hurts us more than money ever could. Internet deceptions afflict everyone, from a child awaiting a pet to a pensioner awaiting a Social Security check. Let's deal with the pets first, as these scams have become more prevalent during the pandemic. Many people, including me, wanted a puppy or kitten to help alleviate the stress of working at home. Unbeknownst to us, there are hundreds of fraudulent websites that prey upon your longing for that perfect pedigreed pet. For instance, I wanted a Maine Coon, but was almost taken in by scams. Maine Coons, the largest cat breed, are highly desirable and typically go for between $1,500 to $4,000. Often there is a waiting list with non-refundable deposits. Internet has acclimated us to get anything we want on demand, and so many fall for these scams. When you Google Maine Coon kittens for sale, or crowdsource for them on Facebook, you'll get hundreds of websites with adorable pets that somehow have not been reserved, selling for bottom basement prices. Here's a screenshot of a scam site. All pet scams use the same methods. Those photos featured here are likely pilfered from reputable breeders registered with the International Cat Association, or Cat Fanciers Association. The kittens would cost thousands. But wait, there's a sale on the site. You can get these gorgeous cats for $400 apiece. If you click on Buy Now, you won't be able to telephone this breeder. Everything will be done online through their websites. But wait, there's more. You'll get your kitten with a half-price shipping rate of a few hundred dollars. It's a bargain, and your pet will be shipped immediately. You'll be asked to pay via Venmo or Zelle or other pay site. As soon as you hit send, your money is lost. By now, you and perhaps your children have invested emotionally in a particular pet. You become a prime target for more deception. Here's what comes next. You'll be asked to cover boarding fees. Perhaps the pet has missed its flight or become ill, and now you must pay for a ventilated cage as well as vet fees. And if you refuse, threats about pet abandonment and legal costs follow. You will never get the kitten or pup. These sites are so numerous that as soon as you report one to the website hosting company, the scammer simply creates another site with a new name and same script. How to spot a scam. To check if you are dealing with a scammer, go to the About tab of the site. Select and copy a suspect sentence that does not sound quite right, perhaps one with awkward word or seldom used phrase, then paste that suspicious sentence into an internet search engine. If it is a scam, you will see multiple websites with the same sentence, all offering kittens depicted with different backgrounds, parenthetically, because photos are stolen from various legitimate breeders, end parenthetical. Other popular scams include fake Amazon charges, Social Security IRS violations, and internet telephone service refunds. No matter the con, fraudsters often read from the same script. Case in point, IRS scammers will state that you are audited and must pay penalties with gift cards or face jail time. The scam has been so successful that the IRS has a video about it. But this is just one of thousands of scams that most of us deal with or ignore daily. The AARP reports up to 150 million illicit calls per month. Hoaxes do as much damage as scams. Those are associated with mainstream and social media and prey upon our fears, beliefs, and values. Here are some common ones. Bullet point. Fear of a certain ethnic, social class, or political group. Bullet point. Belief that people who look different are inherently immoral, moral, unintelligent, or intelligent. Bullet point. Belief in or skepticism about the paranormal. Bullet point. Conviction about a political party, candidate, religious deity, etc. Hoaxers typically persuade us to take action by affirming our fears or validating our biases, and in an age of deepfakes, voice cloning, and conspiracies, we just might take the bait and base life choices on falsehoods. Dealing with emotional fallout. The outcome is not in squandered funds, but in loss of trust and the pervasive feeling that everyone is out to deceive us. If you fear or suspect being scammed, visit the Federal Trade Commission site about what to do and how to report fraudulent activity. If you have been scammed, you are likely feeling unhealthy symptoms, including anxiety, shame, depression, fear, insomnia, and much more. There is no government entity to help with that. Restorative practices include forgiving yourself, joining a local support group, confiding in a psychologist, pastor, mentor, or trusted partner, and becoming active in your community. Serving others, especially in volunteering, builds confidence in yourself and trust in others. Often that is the best remedy. Michael Bujega is the author of Living Media Ethics, Routledge, Taylor, and Francis, and Interpersonal Divide in the Age of Machine, Oxford University Press. He is a regular contributor to Iowa Capital Dispatch and is writing a series of columns on the topic of living ethics. Commentary. Veterans Day. How crosses and mementos help these Marines remember fallen comrades. November 11th, 2021. By Katrina Finkelstein and Derek H. Alderman. On Veterans Day, people across America will thank veterans and active duty military personnel for their service. But many members of the public don't have a clear understanding of what service means to people in the military. How do they honor their own? What kind of spaces and activities help them reflect and remember beyond one day a year? We are cultural geographers who study how people's emotions and connections with the past are represented physically in landscapes. Recently, our research has focused on commemorative place names in the military, particularly names associated with the Confederacy, which the U.S. Armed Forces are now reviewing and renaming. Early this year, one of us, Katrina Finkelstein, visited Camp Pendleton in California to research commemoration on Marine Corps bases and understand how active duty Marines and veterans interact with those bases. In addition to official memorials and monuments sanctioned by the military, there are more informal and intimate examples of commemoration. These ongoing living memorials can be especially meaningful for service members processing their experiences and remembering those they lost, and physically represent the emotional weight they carry every day. A living memorial. Camp Pendleton, one of the U.S. Marines' busiest bases, sits between San Diego and Los Angeles on miles of undeveloped coastline. 1,300 feet above the base, more than 30 crosses stand on a hillside, a memorial site established in 2003. Before deployment to Iraq, a group of seven service members, two Marine officers, two enlisted Marines, two Navy corpsmen, and one Navy chaplain, carried a cross made of an old telephone pole up to the site. It was an effort to remember a peer they lost and to prepare for the mission ahead of them. Three of the seven were later killed in action. Today, the hilltop is used for physical training and events before and after deployments. Meanwhile, its informal commemorations have expanded and changed, as many active duty military and veterans develop a relationship with the space. Destroyed in a fire in 2007, the original cross was replaced and dozens of others added. Some are more intentionally constructed, engraved, and carried up the steep hillside, while others might have been made from sticks on the way. Contributing to the memorials has become an ongoing tradition. In August 2021, for example, after 13 service members were killed in a blast at Kabul Airport, including nine Marines and one sailor based at Pendleton, new crosses appeared on the hillside. Others were erected at different Marine Corps bases, echoing the spontaneous way the first Camp Pendleton cross was installed. This living memorial receives frequent attention, despite its isolated location and despite several official memorials throughout the base. In an oral history interview, one of the original cross bearers from 2003, Chaplain Scott Radetzky, attributes the site's popularity to the life that exists on the hilltop. Because of its more intimate nature, secluded from the public, and requiring an hour-long hike to visit, it has become especially meaningful for service members. The crosses are not a public memorial, he said, but a warrior memorial. More than crosses. On the journey to the Pendleton crosses, people carry mementos to leave at the top. At first, they were small rocks, but have evolved to include sandbags, combat knives, insignia, an open beer and liquor bottles, and helmets, all piled at the base of the crosses. At times, officials have moved to tidy it up, such as removing cans of alcohol, but some service members have objected, stressing that these items are deeply meaningful and carefully chosen. For them, these items they've carried to the top of the hill represent not only their comrades, but the emotional weight that veterans carry each day because of their experiences. Quote, those mementos represented that suffering, that pain, that loss, that anguish, that angst, whatever it was, end quote, that service members needed to leave behind, Radetzky said. The site is not always clean and neat, but he suggests it reflects the messiness of war and the traumatic experiences of the veterans who visit the site regularly. In October 2021, before the battalion that sustained most of the losses at the Kabul airport returned to Camp Pendleton, the group, Recycle for Veterans, which brings veterans together for cleanups on the West Coast, held an event to provide maintenance of the site. The group removed debris and empty bottles, but left mementos behind, leaving it ready for more commemorations in the future. On Common Ground. While many memorial landscapes can seem fixed, representing a single moment or individual, the crosses at Camp Pendleton show that such spaces can actually change. The crosses reaffirm the idea that public memories are not static, and neither are spaces dedicated to them. New features are added as others are removed. The crosses are not without controversy. A decade ago, after the Los Angeles Times ran a story about the memorial on Veterans Day, the Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers filed a complaint, arguing that their presence relegated, quote, all non-Christians who have fought and died for our country, ellipses, to second-class citizenship, end quote. Base officials reportedly conducted a review, and the memorial still stands. For Marines who support the memorial, however, the site can serve multiple purposes. A destination during physical training, a way to prepare for deployment, or a journey to come to terms with their experiences upon returning home. Often these activities are collective. Veterans organize semi-annual hikes, meaning that the site does not become obsolete or forgotten. As the site of an ever-expanding memorial, the hillside is an example of how veterans continue to return their own community to a place that Chaplain Radetzky called a common ground for remembrance and healing. Authors: Katrina Finkelstein is a PhD student at the University of Tennessee, and Derek H. Alderman is a professor of geography at the University of Tennessee. This article is republished from The Conversation under a Creative Commons license. Read the original article. And that does it for today's reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for November 12th, 2021. I'm your reader, Stephen Gazier. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.